It's a hot Thursday evening in Prashanthi Nilayam, but coming to you live from our studios here that is far cooler and pleasanter is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. In spite of all the heat in Prashanthi Nilayam, it's teeming with activity as it is that time of the year when young students eagerly come to Parthi hoping for an opportunity to become Swami students, either in schools or colleges. So wherever we look, we see a lot of youngsters. So wishing all of them the very best and offering our humble pranams as always to Bhagwan's lotus feet, let's begin this week's show. Last week on Radio Sai Answering Booth, I had a listener who asked us three questions and I could answer only one of them. Let's hope that today we'll be able to complete the other two. Even then, it's a tall task to ask. Those of you who follow the show regularly will agree with me when I say that a lot of things that I happen to say on this show is a repetition of what I would have mentioned earlier, or a reiteration of something that we must have discussed in the context of another question. This is so for two reasons. One, well, in a way, that is a limitation of my own knowledge. I tend to try, and I think all of us tend to try, and see a lot of things through a few concepts that we have come to grasp. The other reason is, and the more important one, many a times we think that our doubts, problems and issues are very unique to us. But in reality, they are just another form of a fundamental issue. That's what makes spirituality simple too, isn't it? After all our esoteric expeditions, we will invariably return to the same simple instructions that Swami gives us. Be good, see good, do good. Help ever, hurt never. Love all, serve all. Do work as worship. Consider duty as God. Offer all your actions to God. But what these many questions that we've had the opportunity to handle on the show has given us is the ability to see how much of our life is connected to and can be guided by these very simple adages. Well, talking about simple adages, isn't it time for me to share with all of you a quote before we head to the program of questions and answers? And that is precisely what I'm going to do now. The quote I wish to read for you is that of Joel Osteen, a renowned American speaker and televangelist. And this is what he says, I quote, "When you focus on being a blessing, God makes sure that you are always blessed in abundance." End of quote. I thought that was a beautiful quote. What is it to focus on being a blessing? A few months ago, I had a question on what is it to be an instrument of Swami, and I had mentioned in that course of that discussion that one of the best ways by which we can do that is to live in such a way that when people see us, they are reminded of God. And even if they are not aware of God, they feel reassured in the existence of goodness and purity in the world. We all seek blessings from Swami. We always are on the lookout for some miracle. And when we are in trouble, someone comes and helps us. When we need it so badly, somebody comes and assists us. Or when we are having a tough day, we pine for someone to come and tell us some kind words so we may feel reassured and so on, isn't it? Nothing wrong in doing that, but can we focus on we being that person who brings solace and comfort to another person? Can we focus on being a blessing ourselves for others rather than a curse or a pain? Can we be the conduit of Swami's love and kindness for those whom we come in contact with? Many times when we talk about how we must always strive to be the giver and forgiver, we always have this fear of ending up as losers, isn't it? People say, oh, if I keep giving, what about me? If I keep forgiving others, won't people take undue advantage of me? Fair enough, but tell me, when we set out to earn a living, to make some money, do we ever think of the problems that millionaires and billionaires have in this world? Do we say, oh, after all rich people have sugar, BP and heart trouble, why should I earn money at all? Don't we think, I will first earn money and lead a comfortable life, as though I'm going to be a millionaire tomorrow to worry about all such things? But when it comes to being a person who is always ready to give or let go, we think, what will happen when we become so selfless that people will take us for a ride? I think we all have enough selfishness to look out for ourselves. That's the honest reality. When we really become so selfless, so truly selfless, we would be least bothered if others are going to take us for a ride. But let's not worry about that, because as this quote says, when we focus on being a blessing for others, Swami will make sure that we are blessed in abundance. It's a paradox, but no one becomes a pauper by giving. So let us focus on being that instrument through which people receive Swami's love and blessings always. And then we can be sure that Swami will fill us with abundance. So dear listeners, before we head to the question for this week, permit me to read out that quote by Joel Osteen one more time. I quote, "When you focus on being a blessing, God makes sure that you are always blessed in abundance." Well, let's then head to the question for this week. As I said, it's a continuation of the questions that I played out last week. There were three questions in that recording by Miss Vijaya, who sent us the questions in her own voice. The first one was very long, and those of you who missed last week, the question was on how do you decide when we have to stick to rules and are there occasions when we can relax the rules? She had actually brought up a very beautiful scenario where she has this dilemma as an example for what she goes through in work. The other two questions are completely disconnected from the first one. In fact, they are unique in their own way, the second and third question. So before we try to answer the two of the questions, let's hope that we can complete both of them. But before that, we'll listen to the questions again. I'm going to play the second and third questions alone one more time so that we know what was the things that she had asked last week.
Sarvam, Brother Prem, this is my second question. In the various sharings that I've heard in Radio Sai, often mention is made about the bhava or feeling when we remember the Lord. How can I express this feeling when I do Namasmarana or Bhajan so that it does not become a mechanical routine? My third question is on the theory of creation. I've always grappled with understanding the creation theory. I'm an SSC teacher myself. How can I explain the theory of creation to children and youths in a simple manner? Thank you.
Well, those were the two questions, as you would have heard. One is about the bhava or the feelings with which you're supposed to do bhajans and namasmarana, something which Swami would often remind us that that's the most important aspect of any of these spiritual activities. The other one is, of course, on the theory of creation. I think that's a very general question. I'm not sure how well I would be able to answer that. But nevertheless, I will share a few thoughts on how we can put it across. I'm not going to give you one particular theory of creation which has to be passed on. I don't think there's any one like that which is absolute in that sense that we are supposed to dismiss all other theories and only stick to that. I don't think there is any like that, but I'll share my thoughts on that probably at the end of it. But this question on bhavam, of course, is very important, very, I think, applicable to all of us, right? We all do bhajans, we all do namasmarana, japam or seva, and we know for a fact that if we've heard enough of Swami, we know that Swami is not one who is carried away by the quantity or the external attributes of what we offer. It's always about the feeling, it's always about the intention. That's why Swami would always, we know that that is what Swami is in the lookout for. So it's important to understand what is this bhava. So what is bhavam or feeling, and how do we develop it if it can be developed, if it is a quality that can be developed? One mistake that most of us tend to do is, you know, we judge a person's bhavam or feeling in whatever they're doing, especially bhajans or their regular worship, based on Swami's response. And I think this is more true when we have the opportunity to physically, be in Swami's physical proximity. This is so very often that when Swami responds to a person or Swami picks out one student or a devotee from the crowd, we would automatically believe that this person must be doing whatever he is doing with or she is doing with so much bhavam that Swami is identified. It is true. I'm not telling that it is not so. But one thing that we forget is Swami's response is always very, very loaded. It is not always centered around one particular activity or one particular offering that person has made. And more than that, the timing of his response is always the easiest way to say it. It completely depends on him. There is no modus operandi by which you can say that if you do these, you're sure that within 5 minutes Swami will come and speak to you. I don't think any of us are capable of saying anything like that when Swami was there. And even now, you know, there is no way by saying, I can't tell anybody that if you do these things for 10 days or 15 days, if you do this japam and then on so-and-so date, Swami will come and appear to you and speak to you. The beauty of Swami is that, you know, we can only make the offering and we can make the representation in prayer. It's completely up to Swami when he chooses to respond. So when that is the case, you know, he sometimes responds, when we begin to start something new. That's something which we would see when we would be students in Swami's presence. When we would start a new, spiritual sadhana or whatever it is, that time we would see that Swami comes and responds and Swami would encourage us. And that's a reason why Swami does that, because Swami gives us the confidence that he's happy with what we're doing and he's giving us that courage to go ahead with that. But the same thing, somebody must be doing it for many, many years and somebody may be doing it with a very, very pure intention, but that person might not get the same response. That does not mean that he or she is not doing it with the bhavam, he or she does lacks that bhavam. I think that's something we always mistake. I recall one of my lecturers sharing this beautiful experience that he had much before he became a student. I think this was when he was still living in Hyderabad and he was a young boy then. And he narrated this as one of the first experiences that he had. And apparently Swami had come to Hyderabad, but Swami was visiting some devotee's house, which was about a couple of lanes away from where he was living. And Swami had strictly told the host that he didn't want a crowd on that day. So the hosts were very choosy on whom they invited to their house when Swami was visiting. So they had decided to leave out all the children from the list of people who could be there. And that's how this lecturer, who was a little boy then, his father had the opportunity to go to see Swami, but he was left out. And he narrated how Swami was about a couple of lanes away from his house and he was so hurt that he could not go and see Swami even as a little boy. And he went into this puja room that was in the house. He locked himself up inside the puja room and he started crying in front of Swami's picture. He said, Swami, this is so unfair. How can you not let me come and see you? You've come all the way to Hyderabad and you don't permit me to see you. You come all the way to Hyderabad. You do not come to my house, first of all. And then you come to a house which is so close by and I don't get the opportunity to come and have your darshan. And this boy was so hurt. He started crying, maybe a 7 or 8 year old boy. That's all he was. And he narrates how inside that locked puja room, Swami appeared in his physical form, in flesh and blood, so to say. And Swami consoled him and Swami said, see, I've come here. And this was one of the first experiences this lecturer had. And the same student, probably the same child, probably with the same kind of intensity would have prayed during other times. And not every time the same experience repeats itself. So it would be wrong for us to say that, oh, on that particular day was the only day when this boy actually spoke to Swami in front of his picture or cried out to Swami with bhava, right? On that particular day, Swami chose to respond to that. And that was a response which gave a confidence of a lifetime for this boy, that when he sits in front of a picture of Swami and prays and cries, Swami is actually listening. And sometimes he might appear and respond to the prayer, sometimes he may not. Sometimes he may just choose to be silent. But that confidence that it always reaches Swami, it needs only that one response, right? So the mistake that we do is, you know, we end up judging a person's feeling based on Swami's immediate response. And that was when Swami was physically there. I think now, just like the story I said, you know, whether Swami is appearing to some people or not, or whether Vibhuti is coming out of pictures in their houses or not, and since Swami coming in the dreams, whatever we think are signs that Swami is accepting so-and-so's offering, we tend to judge people's offering and the bhavam which is behind the offering based on these things. To an extent, yes, you can see it. You can see that Swami responds to pure prayer in this form, but it is not always one-on-one. And in fact, as students, we have always seen that sometimes we would write a letter to Swami in a hurry. You know, we would see that Swami is coming along the aisle where we are sitting. So immediately we'll tear a paper out of the notebook and write a letter to Swami. And on that day, Swami will take the letter, Swami will read it out, Swami would spend 2 minutes in front of you reading the letter, Swami would say something to the people around you about you, how beautifully you've written the letter and all that kind of thing. Sometimes you would write a letter with pouring out your feelings. You would be crying and crying and writing a letter, and that letter would be yours to keep. Swami would never take that letter from you. So it's very difficult to look at the response and say whether one person is having bhavam or not. This is just as a cursory note before we go into what exactly is this bhavam. The reason why Swami would do this, that is not responding every time we pray with feelings, or having the response delayed over time, that, you know, Swami always responds to bhavam. That, I'm not saying that Swami does not respond to pure feeling or bhava. Swami always responds, but in a time frame of his own. And the reason why he does that is, the feeling with which we do something, be it singing bhajans or doing japam or doing seva, that feeling should not be attached to anything that is external. Anything that is external, which includes even God's response, right? Even God's acknowledgement of what we are offering to Swami. And that is the reason why I think Swami does this thing, that he always responds, but in his own time frame, making us believe that you do something out of love for Swami, and even if Swami does not respond to it, you continue to do out of love for Swami. And that is what it is. And you don't do it for the response. You don't do it because Swami is looking at you, or Swami is responding to that. But you do it because that's your way of showing love for Swami. And that is to detach our actions from the response is the whole idea behind why Swami responds like that, right? And that's why Swami would make that statement that God is bhava priya and not bahya priya. And bahya means that which is external, and bhava is of course the feeling, right? So bahya is something which is external or dependent on something which is external. So the whole idea is to make our offering, make our prayers bhava centric and not bahya or external centric. So that bahya could even mean the response or the way Swami himself responds to our offering. So one definition or explanation of bhavam is a kind of focus that makes you detach from all the external factors and focus on the one who's being worshipped. Right? That's a definition that we can clearly understand from this. That you don't do it because somebody else is watching you. You don't do it because somebody will come and say that, this person is a devoted person, or this person is doing such a thing with so much bhavam. Right? The ability to detach yourself from all the external factors and focus on whom you're worshipping, right? But it always happens to many of us, I think, let's be honest, during bhajans, the mind wanders, either thinking of something else works that we have to do, or the work that is pending at home or office, or the idea that others are seeing me. Am I appearing like I'm doing bhajan sincerely? Am I appearing like I'm being lost in bhajan singing, right? These kind of thoughts do come. I think, let's be honest with that. We, in a sense, we are becoming self-conscious, right? That's what it is. We are being conscious of others are watching us and others are hearing us. And sometimes we know what are the physical attributes of somebody who is being lost, and we try to imitate that. I think this happens. This is probably the nature of the mind. The nature of the mind is to go outward, right? So then how do we focus? If one of the explanations of bhavam in what we are doing is to be focused on God, so how do we focus? How do we get that bhavam when we are singing bhajans or doing namasmarana or seva or anything? One of it is an experience that I think most of us would have had. When we are in pain or when we are in trouble, automatically the bhavam comes because we are desperately praying to God. And when we are in a crisis, I think it's so easy to focus on Swami and say that, oh Swami, I want this, and Swami, I'm so much in pain, please come and save me, right? So when we are in under stress or when we are in a very critical moment, it's very easy to focus on God. And that's probably why Swami would say that Mother Kunti prays that, give me more troubles in life, right? Because I can see that I'm thinking more of you when there are troubles rather than, when I'm when everything is going hunky-dory in my life, right? But I think that is what shows her devotion. That is what shows what a great devotee Mother Kunti was, because we think of Swami to get over our problems, right? But she realized that thinking of Swami is what's important. So she didn't mind having more problems and inviting more troubles, because that will help her think of Swami more. And I think that's what defines that devotee. But one of the most obvious points I'm making is that when we are in trouble, when we are in pain, we tend to cry out. And when we cry, we are so much more focused on Swami. That is something that we all can see. But if we get stuck in this path, which I think many of us unfortunately do, and that's why Swami would say, you know, Sankatam Vaste Venkata Ramana, Swami would say that the moment there is a trouble, then we can think of God, but not during other times, right? So then Swami says that when you have pain, and only then when you can focus on God, and when the pain goes away, you're not able to focus on God. Swami says that is not bhava, that is not devotion, but that becomes an emotion, right? Yes, there will be focus for that moment, but the conditions around you relax, you move to a more comfortable phase of your life, and then the focus goes away. Then you go about doing whatever other things that you have to do, right? So though pain gives us bhavam at that moment, it's not necessarily the right kind of bhavam. There are a lot of people who from that pain graduate to real bhavam. Mother Kunti is an example of that. She looks at her own mind and she says that whenever I'm getting pain, I'm thinking of God more. So let me find ways of thinking of Krishna more, right? That's what the attitude is. So there is an opportunity to find that bhava in our prayer when we are in trouble and in pain, and then to hold on to that or find ways of holding on to that. But that momentary focus that comes from pain or any kind of stress is not the ultimate bhava, right? So that's why better than such focus is to think of Swami with love and joy. That is, when you do not have a need from Swami, you do not have a prayer, you do not have something that you want to receive from Swami so badly, right? You purely just think of Swami because, you know, it makes you happy to think of Swami. And if you're not, if that is not the option, you're just grateful for whatever things that you're having, that you think of Swami with gratitude. You're not seeking anything in return for that focus that you're offering. That bhava that you're offering does not solicit any form of grace. You're just happy for that moment. When that happens, I think that moment is self-sufficient and complete in itself, right? I don't want anything because I'm thinking of you. I'm just happy thinking of Swami at this very moment, right? So we get completely lost in that moment when that happens. And that is another time when you get that focus on Swami, but you're not self-conscious. As I said, you know, most of the time when we're doing bhajans, we are thinking about the people around us. That's what Swami would say. Some of you don't want to sing aloud, or some of you want to sing aloud, right? Some of you don't want to clap, or some of you want to... There have been many cases like that where Swami would have to tell people that, you know, you're doing too many actions, physical actions while doing bhajans, cut it down, make it simple, right? So all of these things, anything, some of us are very self-conscious and go into a shell. Some of us are self-conscious and become too buoyant. Both of that happens, right? In both cases, we lose focus on Swami. So if we can think of Swami with joy, and that moment we just lose ourselves in that joy, even for a few seconds or whatever is that time period, I think that is the real bhavam which Swami is referring to. And I think that's why Swami would sing this beautiful song, you know, the bhajan that Swami sings, Prema Mudita Manaseka Ho. The word mudita is actually a very beautiful word. I think I might have had the opportunity to speak about it earlier on one of our shows, where mudita actually means causeless happiness, or in other words, selfless happiness. When you see somebody happy and you're happy for that person, I think that quality is sometimes also referred to as mudita, right? There is nothing that you will receive from the good happening to the other person, but you're just happy for that person, right? That is what it is, causeless or selfless happiness. So prema mudita manase kaho is with love and that ceaseless happiness of thinking of Swami. And Swami says, take Rama's name or take God's name in that way, right? So then the question comes, how do you think of Swami like that? How do you get that focus? about not thinking of what you want from Swami. I'm reiterating this. It is not wrong to think of Swami saying that, you know, Swami, I'm in this trouble, please come and save me. Yes, it gives us a lot of focus when we cry out to Swami like that. It gives us such pinpoint focus. I think most of us would have experienced that when somebody who's dear to us is in big trouble. When we pray to Swami, our focus is so very perfect and pinpoint. So I'm not saying it is wrong, but better than that is the ability to think of Swami with joy and think of Swami with causeless, reasonless joy and with love. So the question is, how do we do that? Let's say when you're doing bhajans, how do we get that bhavam? How do we, you know, hit that jackpot, so to say? If you've heard some of the workshops that our bhajan boys, the Prashanti Mandir Bhajan Group boys have done, I think they've done in a lot of places, they come up with a lot of beautiful, innovative suggestions, right? One of the things is, you are not in pain, you are not in need, but you kind of simulate a situation where probably you're in the place of a person who is in need. Like one of the things they would suggest is, there are some bhajans which you can picturize as Draupadi is singing out to Krishna at the moment when she's being dishonored in the Kaurava court. So there are some bhajans which probably so beautifully gel into that situation. It's like a situational bhajan. So they say, can you imagine yourself being Draupadi and crying out to Krishna like this? You're not in pain. It's not that you're really having the trouble, but you kind of simulate. You imagine that you're in that pain. It's all right. I think if that can give us that kind of focus, how beautiful it is to be able to think of Swami and saying that, you know, I'm crying out to Krishna and Krishna is coming to my rescue. Similarly, there are some bhajans which appear like, you know, a devotee is crying out to the Lord to give him darshan or give a darshan, like Mother Shabari is crying out or patiently waiting for Krishna. So that is one of the things that a lot of these people suggest, where visualization during bhajans. So how does all this work? Well, they're all ways of us being lost in the thoughts of God, isn't it? To be able to cut ourselves from what is happening around us and to be completely lost in the thoughts of Swami and the thoughts of God. Especially when we sing bhajans or devotional songs, can we focus on the meaning and in as many ways as possible sing those words truly, right? You know, when we sing out words like Karuna Sindhu or Daya Sagara, these are very, very potent words. Can we really look at the meaning of these words? Because that's another way that Swami would say that, understand what you're singing, understand the prayer that you're making, and feel that meaning and you sing out, right? That's a way by which you can completely connect and focus on Swami. There's a beautiful incident which Professor Nanjundia, the former controller of our examinations in our university, had narrated once. I think this again, those of you who are regular listeners to our shows will not find this new incident, where he narrates that there was once a Kavi Sammelan, or a conclave of poets, so to say, that was arranged in front of Swami, and they'd called some of the best known Telugu poets from Andhra, all around Andhra, to participate in that Kavi Sammelan. And each one's rendition was better than the other. They were so really good, all glorifying Swami, singing of Swami in glorious terms. And Professor Nanjundia was there to witness this particular program. And he was thrilled listening to these great poets with their chaste Telugu praising Swami. And he was so very thrilled with that presentation. And he was floating in the skies listening to this whole program. And he was one of those people who had the blessing of being able to go to Swami's presence in Swami's personal chambers after a program like this. So he was in Swami's presence and he said, Swami, today's program was so good. They all sang so beautifully. They rendered their poetry so very movingly and all that. But Swami didn't seem to reciprocate that kind of thrill. Swami was saying, oh, okay, it was good, or something like that. I don't know what exactly Swami said. So he was surprised. He said, Swami, but didn't you like it? Didn't it move you? Right? You know, being a devotee, I am moved, but didn't it move the God for whom it was meant to? Right? And Swami said, no, I didn't like it so much. Na chale to, Swami said. But then Sir asked, but Swami, it was so good. They sang in such good poetry. Then Swami said, see, these are men of great knowledge and they're very good with language, right? So if you ask them to praise you, they will praise you equally well. So they have been asked to praise me and they praise me, right? Swami said, there is no emotion behind the words that they are rendering, right? They're just good at words and they're presenting those words. And you are being moved because you are able to relate to those words more than the person who has created those words. Swami said, because you are having that feeling towards Swami, you are able to enjoy those words. But the people who rendered it, themselves did not enjoy it as much. And Swami went on to say, see, that is why you see our students, they're so young. They write all kinds of things and give it to Swami and in the name of poetry. This is what Swami said. They write all kinds of things in the name of poetry and give it to Swami. There's no rhythm, there's no rhyme, there is no, great scholarship in that writing. But that moves Swami, that touches Swami because they are writing it with feeling. And that feeling, Swami says, that they mean what they write. If they write Mother Sai, they really mean it. And this is true for all of us. I'm not saying that this is only the students. And this is true because in many ways we have been recipients of such love, right? When we look at Swami and say that Swami is Mother Sai, we need not have physically been in Swami's presence and received that kind of love. But when we look at Swami interacting that way with some students, some devotees, and we consider ourselves as Swami's devotees, we kind of, we infiltrate that group. So we kind of imagine that Swami is our mother too. Swami is, and eventually we all have that experience of Swami showering His love on us. So that experience and that faith that these words are really meaningful. Swami says that is what is the bhavam, and that bhavam touches me. These are Swami's own words. So when we sing bhajans, can we seriously think of the words that we are singing, the meaning of those words, even if we don't have to understand the whole bhajan, just two or three words. Swami would say, even names like Krishna, Rama, Sai, Baba, Swami would say, each one of these have those beautiful meanings which Swami has explained to us every time. So even that, if we can think and, just visualize us speaking those words to Swami or expressing that to Swami without any, we don't want anything from Swami really. Yes, when we want something, Swami is the person to ask. I'm not saying no. But even when we have nothing to ask, if we're able to think of Swami with that love and that costless happiness, I think that is probably the most supremest form of bhavam. Another way of having that focus on Swami is to recapitulate Swami's beautiful form, right? And Swami says that this is one of the advantages that you have when you're in this path of sakar devotion or a devotion where you adore a particular form, that you have a form to contemplate on and focus on, right? And when you keep contemplating and focusing on this God, on this form, Swami says eventually you lose yourself, right? And this is again a technique which Swami himself has said. Swami has told this to students, that you don't have to do, meditate on any particular mantra or something. Swami would say, just sit, close your eyes and think of Swami's form from Swami's, tip of Swami's head to tip of Swami's toe. Just visualize the same form that you've been fortunate to have the darshan of, or to see as a video or a photo or whatever it is. Just trying to visualize Swami's form. And otherwise Swami would say, they just sit and imagine that Swami is walking around for darshan, and just, imagine that entire scene as it is happening, as it happens during Swami's darshan, right? And Swami would say that, the love is already there. Without love, you cannot think of Swami like that, right? How much ever I adore a personality who's very saintly, or in fact, even an avatar of, Swami, like, if I am not a person who is able to relate devotionally to a form like Lord Shiva or even say Lord Rama, it would be very difficult for me to contemplate on that form. But it is so much more easier to contemplate on Swami's form because that basic love towards that form is there. So Swami would say that basic love is there. Through that, when you contemplate on this form, automatically you get that kind of focus, right? So the fundamental idea of bhavam is to detach ourselves from the externals and focus on Swami, right? And eventually that focus in such a way that moment becomes complete in itself. We could start by focusing because of some of the needs that we have, some of the pain that we have, but eventually we get so lost in that focus. And the perfect example of that is Draupadi itself, that scene that I referred to. because that's how it is always depicted, right? And she's in pain. She's in probably the most troubled phase of her life. She's crying out to Krishna. But after she starts calling out to Krishna and contemplating on Krishna, she actually loses herself in that contemplation. She loses body consciousness. That's what, you know, that's how it is depicted, that particular scene. That she loses consciousness of what's happening around her. And then, of course, the miracle of Krishna coming and protecting her honor happens. Right? So it is not that we should not, thinking of Swami when in pain is not bhavam. I'm not saying that. But that alone cannot be complete in itself. But from there, going to this form of devotion where you think of, we think of Swami with love and we get lost in that form of Swami. And, right, I think this is another episode that I've mentioned many times before where Swami looked at one student during the old Vrindavan days and Swami asked him, "Do you love Swami?" And this boy said, "Yes, Swami, of course I love Swami," because, you know, that particular interaction happened where this boy has been standing to have a glimpse of Swami for many hours, and, you know, those days they used to just stand by the window waiting for a glimpse of Swami. So this boy must have been thinking that, "Swami, of course I love you, otherwise why would I be doing this, you know, standing here for so long just to get a word from you?" And Swami looked at this boy and said, "No, but you actually don't love me. You think that you love me, but you actually don't love me." So this boy was taken aback by this comment of Swami, but Swami was actually trying to drive home a very beautiful lesson. Swami said, "If you really love Swami," he said, "you will not even be able to tell me that you love Swami. You will be so lost in that love." Right? So that is the ultimate form of bhavam, where we are completely lost. We are not even able to tell that, do I have the bhavam or do I not have the bhavam? Am I singing with feelings or am I not singing with feelings? That's probably the ultimate, right? So the whole idea is how much we are able to detach ourselves from our situations outside, from our pains and troubles and our needs, and even probably the happy things that are happening, and we are able to focus on Swami. You know, when we sleep at night, we sleep for about 7 or 8 hours. The doctors now tell us that the actual rejuvenation that the body gets, the body and especially the mind gets, is because of the deep sleep state. As we all know, I think we've all experienced this, when we lie down, first we are in a semi-sleep state because we're still awake, but we're just drifting away into sleep. And then we slip into that state where we are still having dreams, right? We refer to that as the state where you're sleepy but you're still having dreams, and then you slip into the deep sleep state where you're completely lost to anything that is outside, anything that's happening around you, and then you wake up and the same process starts, where from that deep sleep you come to a dream state and then you wake up to complete wakefulness. And nowadays the doctors, what they say is, if you sleep for 7 to 8 hours, the deep sleep state is probably just about 1 or 2 hours, right? But that 1 or 2 hours of deep sleep is more than enough to make you alert during the day. When you wake up, you're so fresh and you're ready to go about doing your work because of that 1 or 2 hours of deep sleep state, right? The reason I'm saying this is that deep sleep state, or what is referred to as sushupti, is a state where you're completely lost, right? That being completely lost to the external is what makes this mind rejuvenate itself. And you don't need 7 or 8 hours of deep sleep, just that 1 or 2 hours of deep sleep is enough to give you that kind of freshness, right? Similarly, we may not be able to constantly focus the way I've been explaining, you know, on Swami, right? Of course, that is the ultimate goal. That's where we all need to get. That's where we are eventually heading towards. But till then, when we are doing bhajans or when we are singing, doing japam or whatever we are doing as an offering to Swami, I think even those few moments when we lose ourselves is good enough to give us that kind of fulfillment. You don't have to sit through an entire bhajan with that focus. I think even in one bhajan, if we think of Swami with such focus, I think after the bhajan session, we'll get up and we'll feel that, "Oh, today's bhajan was so very beautiful," right? And, you know, I'm sure this is everybody's experience. I'm not saying something which is so outlandish, right? Yes, we have to strive towards the state where we, whatever we do, we completely do with that focus and we get lost in Swami in that manner. But till then, I think even those few moments of losing ourselves, one word or one bhajan which we are so fond of or one line in a bhajan, there are people I know who are very fond of a couple of lines in the aarti. And that is when they actually really connect to Swami. It doesn't matter, even those few moments is good enough. I'm sure this happens at many homes, especially where there are children. You know, when children refuse to sleep, saying that I'm not feeling sleepy or I don't want to go to bed, which happens a lot of times in many homes, right? And parents would generally say this, you know, don't worry. I know that you're not feeling sleepy. It's okay. You just go turn off the lights in your room and lie down and cover yourself with a blanket. Eventually you will fall asleep, right? This is something which I think most of our parents would have told us. I think same is the case with the devotional activities and the bhajan singing that we are doing. Just because I am not able to focus on Swami throughout the bhajan, it does not mean that I give up the activity altogether. It's the same thing just like how what we said about deep sleep state. You switch off all the lights, you go to bed. Yes, initially you will not get sleep and then you will get a disturbed form of sleep, but eventually you will go into that deep sleep state. The same is the case with all of these activities. So even if we feel that I'm not feeling that bhava, no problem. I think we should continue doing that bhajans, continue doing our japam, etc. And I think eventually we will get that focus. Till then, over time, whenever we realize that the mind is wandering, right, when we're sitting for bhajans, and as I said, you're thinking about what the others are thinking and others are watching you, or you're thinking of the other activity that you have to do. Just acknowledge that the mind is wandering, and every time that you acknowledge, when you realize that the mind is wandering, just focus on Swami for that few moments and say, Swami, please give me focus on you. Swami, please give me love for you. I think that's a very easy way of going about this particular ability to inculcate bhavam into whatever we do. Before I wind up this part of the answer, just one extension of whatever I've been speaking so far. The question was about how do we induce bhava in spiritual activities that we do. But another aspect that is more important is to find expression for this bhava in our everyday life and everyday activities. And without this expression of bhava in the rest of the day and the rest of the activities that we do, the bhava that we have in our spiritual activities, I dare say this, is quite pointless actually. See, when we go into this deep sleep state or sushupti, as I said, we completely lose body consciousness. And that's what happens when we go into deep sleep state. We lose body consciousness. We lose our idea of where we are lying and what we are and who we are and all of that. And when we have enough of this deep sleep state, what does it result in the rest of the day or when we are awake? When we are awake, we are completely alert and sharp, right? That's what this deep sleep state does to us in our wakeful time. So if we have not had good enough sleep, then we'll be groggy and we'll be sleepy and drowsy and all of that. But if you have had that enough deep sleep, then when we are awake, we have to be alert and we will be able to be very sharp, right? Similarly, when we are able to experience bhava in our spiritual activities, bhajans and all the other activities that we are speaking about, it should make us alert during our other activities or during our other times. That is, our discrimination of what is right and wrong and doing things in a way that Swami expects us should become easier, which means just like how deep sleep results in alertness when we are awake, doing more of these activities with the right bhavam will reflect in the way we are going about activities, making right decisions and making the right decisions more and more effortlessly, right? And that's why this idea of losing one's body consciousness and being aware in the moment is very, very closely related. They appear like, two distant sides of the same thing. That one is you lose yourself and one is you're being completely aware. But that is what it is. When we lose ourselves in these moments when we are doing devotional activities, it should result in being more present when we are doing some things. That should result in when I'm doing some activity, I am sharp and I'm aware and I'm awake to that activity that I'm doing. And I'm making right decisions, right? And that is what it is when, when we infuse bhavam into the spiritual activities that we do, that is one aspect of it. But this bhavam is actually otherwise very difficult to explain. I think you would have understood that by now, the way I'm struggling to explain what bhavam is. It's because it's a feeling and it cannot be explained beyond a certain amount through words, right? A feeling can never be expressed through words as adequately as, you know, one understanding it intuitively, right? So this bhavam is actually very difficult to express itself. So we need to find situations in our life where this bhavam can find expression, right? So we must be alert for such opportunities when we have a choice between a pleasant option and an option which is clearly what it would be to follow Swami. Our eyes must really light up and say that, oh, this is an opportunity to express my love for Swami, or this is an opportunity for me to express that Swami is a higher priority for me than other things. So I will do what pleases Swami. So when we work sincerely and say, let's say that we get insulted in return, or you know, we are not getting the kind of appreciation that we must get from our colleagues and peers, we must think that I will continue to work sincerely because here is an opportunity for me to express how Swami is more important for me, and I am doing what I'm doing for Swami, not for the response I'm getting from others. So there are many such situations where there are actually opportunities to express our obedience, express our surrender, express our love for Swami in the form of the priority that we give to Swami. So when we have bhavam in our spiritual activities like bhajans and japam and whatever, meditation and all of that, that should result in the expression of that bhavam through these choices and decisions that we make during our time. We be alert to situations. When certain situations come, we must not look at them as problems and run away from them, but say that, okay, here is an opportunity for me to express that inexpressible bhavam that we would be thinking about. How else do you express surrender rather than acting it out in this manner, right? So the bhavam that we have while doing bhajans and japam and all of that must express as the change in our way of thinking and acting during the rest of the day, during our course of rest of the activities. That is also a good way of checking if our bhavam is truly devotional or and not purely emotional, as Swami said. Because emotion is just a momentary hike in emotions, right? But the devotion is that which something stirs within and it completely changes. That focus is what is devotion, right? So this is what I wanted to say, that bhavam is nothing but that pure focus on Swami. That focus can come when we are in pain, but it is even better if you're able to get that focus thinking of Swami with love and with joy, because in that case, that moment becomes complete in itself. You're not looking for anything as a result of that moment, but that moment is self-sufficient, complete in itself. And the more and more we have such moments when we are indulging in a spiritual activity, we tend to lose ourselves in that moment. We are completely disconnected from the external world and things happening around us, and we're able to focus on Swami. I think that is what is bhavam, and as I said in the last few minutes, that bhavam should express in the decisions that we make in life, in the choices that we make in life, and the way we lead our life, right? And that is probably a good barometer of whether we are doing all these spiritual activities with bhavam. Coming to the third question, as I said, I'm not going to be speaking much about that. That's why I didn't leave much time for this question. How do we explain the theory of creation, especially to children? That's really a tough one. If you're talking about purely how do you teach this to SSC children, I'll come to that in a bit. But I think if you're asking about generally telling to children, I think my idea is children should be taught what their respective religions and scriptures speak about as how the creation has come about. I think it's very important because there are different versions of that. As we all know, the different scriptures speak of it differently, but it doesn't matter. The idea is not to give them the most accurate picture of the theory of creation. I don't think there is one particular accurate theory in that sense. All of these are symbolic. All of these try to convey a profound message which probably has to be put in the form of symbols and stories. So if you're talking about children, teaching them the theory of creation, I feel they should be taught what is taught in their respective religions and cultures. But in the process, make it clear that these are all merely interpretations or the ideas that are expressed in the form of stories, right? Maybe if the seers of the past were to explain the same stories on the same concept of creation now, maybe they would be using more scientific terms, right? Because we have gathered that knowledge. It's not because they did not have better ways of explaining it. They put it in words which were understandable for people of those times. Now we have more scientific knowledge, and we have words that can express some things better than earlier. For instance, we say that the first god among the Dashavatars, God comes first as a fish, and then he comes as a turtle or a tortoise, right? The Matsyavatar and then the Kurmavatar. Though we say that he came in the form of a fish or a tortoise, Swami would explain this. The idea is that the first being was actually aquatic, and then eventually it became amphibian. And that is what is told as fish and a tortoise. But it's not, if you look at it, the species of fish or the species of tortoise must have evolved much later. The idea is aquatic and amphibian. So teach the children whatever their respective religion and scripture speaks about as the theory of creation, but also put this knowledge that it is not something that needs to be stuck to, because it is only representative, and one must be open to understanding it as we learn more scientific concepts and theories, that they should not have a difficulty in understanding the theory of creation as told in the scriptures and the scientific understandings that come. They should be told that the scientific explanations are the processes, right? For instance, let's say that somebody who is in the US is going to give me a gift. So I say that so-and-so gave me a gift. So that is what is the simplest description of the event. But how would that person have sent me the gift? He would have probably gone to a shop and he would have bought it. He would have, gone to a courier company and given my address. So there is a process to it. But the whole thing is actually so-and-so gave me a gift, right? So science is always speaking about the process. When you say that God created the world, science speaks about the process. It says there was a big bang and this is what happened, and then there was condensation, and then this mass exploded, or whatever it is. That's the process. So if we can convey this to the children, that we need not feel that what is being told in the scriptures is completely contrary to what science is telling, we can just say that what is being told in our scriptures is representative, and accept it with a kind of an open mind. Now, if you're just asking about SSC children, how do we explain this to SSC children, especially those who have exposure to Swami's message and those who are likely to have exposure to Swami's message as they grow up? I think what you teach about creation to them should seamlessly lead to some of the basic principles of Swami's message. And one of that is what Swami would often say as Sarvam Kaluidam Brahma, all that you see is divine. Right, all the human beings and all the other living beings that you see are essentially divine. Because this is one of the fundamental messages that Swami gives, and a lot of things that Swami says thereafter depends on this understanding. So when we teach the theory of creation, this idea should seamlessly lead to this idea that everybody is divine. So I think that is why the description that is given in Purusha Suktam, I feel, is very, very beautiful, where it doesn't say that God created the world, but it says that one part of God became the world, right? You have these lines in Purusha Suktam which says, Padosya Vishwa Bhutani Tripadasya Mritam Divi. One quarter is what we see. One quarter of that Purusha or that divine being became all that we see, and three quarters remains unmanifest. Right, that's what the Purusha Suktam says. So God does not create the world, but God separates one small part of his own being to form this world. And that's what Swami says, I separated myself from myself to love myself. So when we say that a part of God became this manifest world, I think it's easier to explain to children that whatever you see is divine, right? Because it is divine. It is not that God created the world, but God became the world in that sense. Right, and I think a couple of months back we had a question on the three gunas and understanding the role of the three gunas. I think there I'd explain this idea of where we have this idea that God created the world by creating the five elements, where he first created the akasha. From the akasha came the vayu, from the vayu came agni, from agni came water, and from water came earth. And I think in that particular answer I had explained where the first things that came are not the physical sky, earth, water, air, and fire and all of that. But this unmanifest God who has no attributes, who cannot be known because he does not have any attributes, allows himself to be known by first allowing himself to be heard. And that's how that the subtle akasha comes, and where the expression of that is the pranava mantra. Swami says, so Om is the starting of everything, because the first attribute that attributeless God took upon himself so that we can know him is the attribute of the ability to hear him. And that's how the pranava comes, right? And that's why it is supposed to be the primordial form of God. And from there, Swami says, akashat vayuhu, from being able to hear him, to be able to feel him. And that's why the wind now not only can be heard, but it can also be felt. And from there, Swami says, vayur agni, fire can not only be heard, can not only be seen, not only be felt, but can also be seen. The ability to see comes with fire. And from fire, Swami says, apa, where the attribute of taste gets added. And from apa, the idea of earth comes, right, where the attribute of smell also keeps added. I'm not sure how best it is to explain this to children. I think that completely depends on the age group with which we are talking to. But if we can understand this whole thing, as Swami says, that's what he says, that, you know, this is how the elements were created. First, the attributes of the elements were created, and then Swami speaks about that process of panchikritam, where the three gunas and these subtle elements or tanmatras, as Swami would say, they go through this process of permutation and combination, and that's how you have the five elements. And then Swami says the five elements form the basis of everything that is physical, because everything that is physical has to have any one of these attributes. If they do not have these attributes, then that becomes divine. And Swami says that attributeless nature is there in each one of the beings as the soul. And that is why that essentially everybody is divine. Even the inanimate objects are divine, because attributeless aspect of divinity is existent in each one of them. And Swami says that this is how variety is formed. Different kind of people are formed, and different kind of beings and beasts and birds and all of that is formed. But Swami says these are all changing, because these are still forming, and you know they decompose and they take another form. But what is changeless is the divine aspect, which is unchanging. So this is the basis of what Swami says is how creation goes about. I'm really not sure how helpful was that what I said, but I hope the guidepost which I gave was clear. One is, I think children should be taught what their particular religion, what their particular scripture speaks about. And it should be explained that these are words of seers who kind of tried to understand how creation came about, and they tried to pass on that knowledge through cryptic stories and through cryptic, in whatever way they could put it across, which today, with the knowledge of science that we have, might look obscure and which might look absurd, but it is not so. So can we teach the theories which are there in scriptures with this idea that, you know, this is only representative, don't get stuck to this. But even as you are learning more things, you will see how this pans out. And if you really want to teach them, especially if you want that the children as they grow up should seamlessly accept Swami's message or understand Swami's message, I think what Swami says in the form, in the Vedas say of how the God does not create creation but becomes creation, one part of God becomes creation, that is why the unmanifest God is beyond us. That's what they say, that with all our knowledge we can understand divinity which is within this realm of the world, but if you want to understand the avyakrita aspect, or that which is beyond manifestation. Swami says that that's when you completely transcend this physical existence. As I said, I don't know how far that was helpful, but that's just a way I thought I can put it across. So thank you, Sister Vijaya, for those three questions. Three questions, all of them were different and all of them were profound. I hope whatever I said was useful, at least to a certain extent. Thank you again for asking those questions. That, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show. If you have a question, feel free to write to me. I invite questions to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. If you could record the question in your own voice, that would be wonderful, like the listener today. It's always nice to have a different voice. I would appreciate if the questions are on practical spirituality, practical aspects of expressing Swami's message in our day-to-day life. I think that's what is the most important thing that we need to do, because the theory, as Swami says, we all are getting very well versed with the theory, but the practice is where all of us stumble. So this is an opportunity for all of us to together try and understand how Swami's message should manifest in our lives, and that's the whole endeavor of this program. So with the prayer that Swami helps us to not only see how to express Swami's life in our practical life, Swami's message in our practical life, but He blesses us even with the strength to do that. I offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful song. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang.
Nagme hai, shikve hai, kisse hai, baate hai. Nagme hai, shikve hai, kisse hai, baate hai. याद आती है दिल में बस जाती है याद आती है दिल में बस जाती है ये यादें तेरे प्यार की यादें हैं कभी भूले नहीं पाएंगे ये दर्शन जो तेरा आँखों में जम जाए ये मुस्कान जो तेरी हर दम साथ रह जाए